That's why they started resistance against Soviet Union. They called Mujahideen.
Yes.
And of course, finally, on the 1373, he was martyred by the Taliban government at that time. And of course, later the president of Afghanistan gave the title of Shahid-e-Wahdat-e-Milli, or the martyr of national unity.
That's all right. Okay.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah. Besides his religious life, we know that he had, for example, the ijaza, or the permission from the late Imam Khomeini, in order to gather the wujuhat, the monies that become on that time in Mazar Sharif and the regions around. So I think religiously and scholarly speaking, he was fully authentic, but politically he felt this commitment to get back to his country, Afghanistan, and struggle over there against communism and the Soviet Union. So Sheikh Fadai, I think he was very much after a kind of resistance power, and the resistance group or resistance ideology in the region. I could sum some of the footage, the videos and the photos of Abdul Ali Mazari and Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi, the late Lebanese Hezbollah political party. So can we say that he, alongside with the other scholars in Afghanistan, in Lebanon, in Iraq and Iran, thereafter establishing a kind of Islamic party, I mean the Shiite party?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, when I think about Abdul Ali Mazari, he reminds me of the book from our Supreme Leader and Sanad is Panjah Saleh, 250-year-old man. So what is the relationship between this figure and that book? You know, in that book, which is a combination of the different lectures of Ayatollah Khamenei, Ayatollah Khamenei talked about the history of our imams. And to sum it up, he wants to say that all of our imams, like one person, acted in order to have the power and have Islamic government, so they can show real Islam. Because yes, without power, without government, we cannot have real Islam in our society. You know, if we want to give the government to taghuts all the time, you know, we had a lot of scholars that they were silent in front of taghut government. That is wrong. Mm-hmm. The real scholars, Islamic scholars, they never remained silent in front of taghut. As our imams tried a lot in order to gain power and establish Islamic government, we can see that by this pattern, our real Islamic leader, if they're even after imams, for example, our fuqaha or some activists, and Muslim activists like Abdul Ali Mazari, they want to follow this pattern of Ahlul Bayt, that real Islam and Shia should gain the power. We shouldn't be silent in front of the government of Taghut. You know, he had a good relationship with the Iranian revolutionists and Lebanese revolutionists. For example, in Iran, he studied in Qom, had a good relationship with Imam,
yes,
and even he went to Lebanon and had some sessions and relation with connection with Sayyid Abbas Musavi, as you mentioned. So, you know, these actions means that we together, whether from Afghanistan or Iran or from Lebanon, we have to join together in order to stand in front of the government of Batil.
Yes.
He, I think he followed this pattern of Ahlul Bayt. And I think for his capacity, he was successful.
Yes.
Yes, he was martyred.
Yes.
Because he didn't have that potential in Afghanistan to have a revolution like Imam Khomeini in Iran.
Yes.
As the scholars before Imam Khomeini couldn't have this. Yes. But according to his capacity, he could have it. Why do I say that? Because, as you mentioned, he was called the martyr of national unity.
Yes.
It means that he was successful to gather people, Muslims, together in order to stand in front of the government of Batil.
Yes, that's right. إِنَّ فِي الْجَنَّةِ نَهْرًا لَبَنْ إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من He got martyred, Shaykh Rouhani. In Afghanistan. From one side, he was against the Communist Party led by the Soviet Union. From the other one, the radicals in Afghanistan were after power, so he again tried to, we can say, oppose them, struggle against them, and finally he was martyred by them. Can you give us more details about the story and his struggles, other political struggles in Afghanistan?
Yes, of course. He was at the same time a social activist as well, because one of the problems that we have in countries like Afghanistan is the discriminations that are leveled against minorities. You know, for example, the Shiite people in Afghanistan, since they are minority, in the history of this country, different kind of discriminations, oppressive kind of discriminations leveled against these people. That is why one of the objectives of his resistance was this, to bring back, let's say, this dignity or izzah or, let's say, karama of the Shiite people in Afghanistan. So that's why from this perspective, some of the radical movements, Sunni radical movements, were opposed to him,
yes,
against him. That's why he got martyred, because of this, that he was very strongly and seriously trying to support Tashayyu in Afghanistan and the school of Ahlul Bayt in Afghanistan, and to help and support the followers of this school and these, let's say, branches of Islam.
Yes.
That is why, since resisting against this sort of discriminations that leveled against these people by the governments, that's why there were some groups who were opposed to him. That's why he finally got martyred.
Is it true that first, for example, they signed an agreement? That's why, for example, they signed an agreement with the radical groups in Afghanistan, but then they violated this agreement and martyred.
Yeah, it is what is written in the biography of this great Shaheed is that, yes.
Okay, that's all right. And still, this group of the, as we said, we called him the martyr of the national unity. Were there, for example, other Sunni groups who followed him as a Shiite figure or not?
And to, you know, there were sometimes there were Sunni Shia parties. They they were like what we can say. They had some kind of coalition, what we can say, gathering with each other. and they followed some kind of resistance together. Mm-hmm. So that's why you had sometimes, for example, some Sunni parties. They were also members of the unity that was established by this Shaheed and the other, let's say, leaders of the different political parties.
Yes.
But of course, but mainly his party was the Shiite party.
Okay. And it's still the Shiites in Afghanistan, during the history of Afghanistan, have been among the minority or the majority, Sheikh?
No, now still they are minority in Afghanistan, yes. Some 30% of the population 30%. Of Afghanistan, yes. Is Shia, yes.
That's right. Okay. Thank you very much. It was very kind of you. As we said, there was an agreement between the two, the radical groups. And I think based on akhlaqi method and principle, Shaheed Mazari signed the agreement.
Yeah.
In order to give the weapons so that they might sit around the table and sign again an agreement on the national unity of Afghanistan. But unfortunately, on Isfand 22nd, 1373, according to the solar calendar, when he and the other members of his group of the Wahda party were taken to Kandahar, they were assassinated inside the helicopter.
Yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
Unfortunately, on the way by the radical groups over there. So many memorandums and letters and messages from different ulama of Iran and all across the Islamic lands, Basan and his martyrdom. And he is still remembered as a shaheed of struggle or shaheed of muqawama and resistance in Afghanistan, the late Shaheed Abdul Ali Mazari. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man. Thank you much, Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration on his life. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fiamat.
We once had a teacher, the teacher of teachers. He changed the world for the better and made us better creatures. Oh Allah, we've shamed ourselves, we've strayed from Al-Mu'allim. Surely we've wronged ourselves, what will we say in front of it? Mu'allim.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. According to a newly released video and audio, Savannah Graziano, a 15-year-old teenager who was abducted by her father in September of 2022, was shot and killed by sheriff's deputies as she followed their instructions and ran towards them on the side of a California highway. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of the story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Newly released law enforcement video footage captures the moment California police fatally shot an unarmed 15-year-old teenage girl who was reported kidnapping victim. On 27th of September 2022, the San Bernardino County Sheriff's deputies were searching for Savannah Graziano, who was feared abducted by her father, Anthony Graziano, after he had fatally shot her mother the day before. The deputies found Anthony Graziano's vehicle on the side of a freeway in Hesperia, just 80 miles east of Los Angeles, California. When Savannah Graziano exited the vehicle, they opened fire and killed her. The shooting sparked national concern, with critics questioning how police officers wound up killing the teenage girl they were tasked with rescuing. Sheriff's officials claimed following the shooting that it was unclear whether Savannah was shot by deputies or her father, and they said deputies didn't realize it was her when she got out of the car. For nearly 2 years, they refused to release the video footage of the incident. But recently, the department disclosed nearly a dozen video files to the independent journalist Joey Scott, who filed records requests 18 months prior. The video clips, which were shared with Guardian and include helicopter footage, show deputies shooting at Savannah as she followed their instructions to move towards them. The videos also suggest deputies shot her after two police officers remarked that it was the girl who exited. The video footage and the sheriff's narration of the video further make clear she was killed by the deputies and not by her father. The sheriff's department has declined to comment on the case. The video footage will increase scrutiny on the Sheriff's Department, already under fire after deputies recently killed Ryan Gaynor, an autistic 15-year-old teenage boy. Ryan Gaynor was having a mental health episode when he was fatally shot by two deputies within seconds of encountering him. The killing raised concerns about the use of lethal force on children and failures to de-escalate crises. The search for Savannah started on 26th of September 2022 when her father, according to officials, shot and killed her mother and shot at her father and his child outside a school in nearby Fontana, California. Authorities on that day issued an Amber Alert for Savannah, saying she was suspected, abducted or taken by her father. The following morning, a 911 call reported seeing Graziano's pickup truck and Savannah purchasing items at a gas station. Police soon located Graziano speeding on a nearby freeway, prompting the start of a chaotic chase. When deputies caught up with the vehicle, shots were fired from inside towards police, according to the police department, which shared photos that showed its cars were damaged. The video footage released on Friday, 29th of March, is the first to shed light on what happened next. Filmed by a California Highway Patrol helicopter, it captures Anthony Graziano speeding through traffic and deputies reaching him after he attempted to drive up an embankment but lost traction. When the car stopped near deputies, the video footage shows Savannah exited the vehicle, and a CHP official on the radio can be heard stating, "Girl is out, the girl is out, guys. She's out on the passenger side." The video shows she crouches on the ground for about 10 seconds and then walks towards a group of about 7 deputies, followed by a boom that appears to be at least one deputy shooting at her, though the department blurred out Savannah at this moment. The CHP dispatcher can be heard saying, "Oh no." The deputies were not wearing body cameras, but the department also shared audio from the belt of the deputy standing closest to the girl. That audio captures the deputy shouting, "Passenger, get out," as gunfire is heard in the background. The deputy then shouts, come to me, walk, walk. Then he says, hey, stop shooting at her. He's in the car. At least four shots can be heard in the background after he said to stop. The sheriff's statement describing that audio said, you can hear a deputy calling her over and telling other deputies that the person who exited the truck was the passenger and for them to stop firing, but it was too late. Savannah was pronounced dead at a hospital. Anthony Graziano was also shot by deputies and died at the scene, though the video clips do not make clear when that happened. The website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. The evidence released recently also does not make clear who fired at police from inside Graziano's vehicle. The sheriff's department has suggested that Graziano was firing at police officers and that it's possible that Savannah also fired at police officers. The department said this aspect of the incident remains under investigation. CJ Wyatt, Savannah's uncle, said he understood it was a confusing and chaotic situation for police officers to manage, but that his niece should not have been shot at. There needs to be better training so that unarmed people aren't killed. Hopefully this video can be used for training purposes. Something has to be done differently. She didn't have to die. Savannah's uncle added, in the video, the police response appeared disorganized and it sounded as if at least one deputy who was calling Savannah was trying to protect her. You can tell he was really trying to save her, so it's just unfortunate that there was some kind of miscommunication between the police officers. He clearly knew it was Savannah, so what is the difference between him and the other police officers? Wyatt said blame ultimately lied with Savannah's father, who he described as abusive and manipulative. As her parents were separating in the weeks prior to the incident, Savannah had been living in her father's truck, he added. She was a really sweet girl at her core and she didn't deserve this. He also paid tribute to his sister, Tracy Martinez, killed by Graziano, his father. She was a dedicated mother, a hard worker, as a pharmacy technician, and a caring individual. He said he hoped more people struggling with abuse reached out for help. Sharon Brunner, a civil rights lawyer in San Bernardino, California, said it appeared no one was in charge of coordinating the police officer's strategy. She said it was possible there was contagious fire, with deputies' own shots encouraging others to fire. She said San Bernardino County does not train law enforcement to handle these high-stress situations appropriately. They have a very brutal approach of shoot first, ask questions later. She said there could have been better efforts to control the scene and get Savannah to safety. It sounds like the Wild Wild West and an innocent child lost their life because of it. Jim Terrell, another local civil rights lawyer, said the case followed a pattern of department using undisciplined firepower. Jim Terrell added, cover and assessment are replaced with fear, anxiety, and lots of shots fired. The California Department of Justice is investigating the case under a law requiring inquiries into police killings of unarmed people. Officials have not named the involved police officers. The video footage puts more pressure on an already embattled police department. In addition to the killing of Ryan Gaynor, the police department has faced criticism after a video recently captured a deputy punching and kneeing a man under arrest in Hesperia, California. In December, a sheriff's deputy was arrested on suspicion of being under the influence of cocaine, and he resigned.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iraq, Pakistan, Oman, Qatar, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Cuba, Venezuela, China, and Russia have all slammed the Israeli airstrike on Iran's embassy in Damascus, Syria. Yet the so-called flag bearers of international law and conventions in the West have kept mum about Israel's blatant violation of international law. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has vowed that Tehran will make the occupation regime regret its deadly airstrike on the Iran embassy in Damascus. Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let's get us started. These are my guests in this episode of The Spotlight. Vanessa Vila, independent journalist, is joining me out of Damascus. Also with us is Richard Merthurst. He's a journalist and commentator in Vienna.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now, welcome to the show. Now, beginning with Vanessa, let's first talk about what the motive could be behind this operation. The majority of the experts and analysts that we've spoken to, speaking of provoking Iran, Israel trying to provoke Iran into engaging in war so that Israel could spread further instability and insecurity across the region. Your thought on this?
Well, I think just before Christmas last year, Yoav Gallant made it quite clear that they needed a victory in this war in order to survive in the Middle East. So this is an existential war for Israel. It's been evident since October the 7th that they are desperately losing the war in Gaza against a relatively ill-equipped Palestinian resistance. They have had to evacuate from the northern occupied territories more than 100,000 settlers, as far as we know, in the contained war against Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. And so now they deem it necessary to expand the war, particularly into Syria, because we have to remember that this is the fourth in a series of attacks in the last 7 days. And all of these attacks have been carried out in conjunction with an upsurge in attacks by the terrorist groups across all the axes, particularly in the northwest and in central Syria. So, you know, the masks have fallen. People can now see exactly who is the real axis of evil in the region, the real axis of terrorism. Those that are silent about this appalling attack, people in Damascus, are still in shock that this has actually happened. I mean, this is an escalation beyond expectations. So Israel wants to expand the war. The resistance axis has been trying to restrict that expansion, but it remains to be seen if that remains the status quo.
All right. Now, let me turn to Vienna. Richard, the UK just a couple of hours ago summoned the Israeli ambassador, and that because three British aid workers got killed in Gaza. Now, when it comes to proportionality, you tell me, what is then Iran entitled to do now that it's lost several of its senior nuclear scientists and also military commanders at the hands of the Israeli regime?
Well, the Israelis want the Iranians to turn this into a full-blown war because it would suit them. But I think, you know, the axis of resistance, not just Iran, but all of the resistance have proven over time that they are not ones to be tricked or to fall into traps. Although it's understandable that Iran's response should be just disproportionate, I think that as Iran have said, and they always respond and they will do it at the right time. Regarding the British summoning over the killing of three aid workers, what's interesting is that we have a chorus. We have all of these Western officials talking about the world central kitchen issue in Gaza, which is important. Mm. But they're doing that to avoid talking about this unprecedented attack on the embassy. I mean, speaking of proportionality, we have to talk about this more because, you know, we've never seen a so-called state attacking the embassy of another state in a third state. Hmm. I mean, this is a violation of the UN Charter. It's a violation of the Vienna Convention, the Geneva Convention. It's so egregious. It's unprecedented. The fact that the British government don't even care enough to summon the Israelis over that alone, or any other ambassadors that are in Europe or the West to be summoned over this issue is scandalous, and it really shows you where their priorities lie.
Right. Now, Vanessa, some observers citing the reason for Israel to do this as an act of desperation, and that's mostly thanks to the failures it's facing in Gaza. It's not been able to defeat one single resistance group in Palestinian occupied territories. And also, maybe these anti-Netanyahu protests on the home turf, you know, a host of, you know, issues, the Israeli economy and all that. Do you share the same view?
Yeah, absolutely. As I mentioned, you know, Israel is not only losing the strategic and military war, it's losing desperately the propaganda war, its entire edifice of propaganda that has propped it up for since its creation as a illegal settler colonialist state by the British, and then of course it was adopted by the states. The entire anti-Semitism trope has been destroyed, particularly, of course, by the case of Professor David Miller, that has now stated very clearly that being anti-Zionism is acceptable. And you know, their entire defense for this genocide that they're committing, not only in Gaza but in the West Bank, which is based upon an entire series of lies that they produced from October the 7th onwards that have now gradually been completely debunked. The world is seeing them as they are, and their economy has taken a massive hit. Military morale is at its lowest. Settlers are leaving the Zionist entity itself. And the Zionist entity can only survive with settler support. So if settlers are starting to decide that it's no longer offering them security, they will leave. And then what is left? And also, you know, which country in its right mind now is going to be looking at investment in the future in a country that is clearly responsible for genocide of Palestinians across the territories?
Now, Richard, why shouldn't they learn a lesson from their past mistakes, like when they assassinated Iran General Soleimani? What did they gain? The resistance front even got stronger and got, you know, a boost in the arm. Now they are again killing Iranian commanders at a lower level compared to General Soleimani, the icon of the anti-terror and anti-Daesh, actually, in this part of the world.
I mean, without question, they gained nothing. The resistance got stronger. We can see the same pattern with Hamas, for example, when the Israelis thought, okay, if they assassinate Sheikh Ahmad Yassin, that this will destroy Hamas. Look at Hamas today. I mean, they've launched a full-blown war and they can't even defeat them. So imagine with Iran how much stronger that is. It's, you know, the axis of resistance has shown over time that no matter what actions the Israelis and Americans take, they are losing on the chessboard. They simply cannot get around the failures that they are, you know, experiencing at home, so to speak, and on the battlefield. And this is actually why they assassinate. They lash out like a cat, you know, clawing someone, because they are terrorists deep down. This is who they really are. And it's not just the assassination of the high-ranking officials here. It's really, we have to understand this as an attack on Iran itself, because that's really what it is. You know, the Israelis have done this, these attacks on Iran and its sovereignty before, and the same thing in Syria. But this is on an unprecedented level. And you look at the terror at Al Shifa Hospital. This is something, in my opinion, that they were trying to hide and distract from. But again, it's on a deeper level here. The Israelis are trying to find some kind of victory. They think that they can overcome their failures by assassinating people, and it's not going to happen. And I should point something out, that they are doing this on multiple levels. We had a terrorist attack in January in Iran, which ISIS supposedly claimed responsibility for it. Mm-hmm. We had another ISIS attack in Russia. We had a recent terrorist attack in China. Do we really think this is a coincidence that there are all these assassinations? General Mousavi is another one, Saleh Haruri, and all these terrorist attacks by ISIS and Al-Qaeda who are known to have links to America and Israel. It's not a coincidence.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now, Vanessa, Richard mentioned something, and what the Israeli regime did is actually a violation of Iran. It means an attack on Iran, because a sovereign country's diplomatic premises was targeted and hit. It was also the host country's. So it's a violation of international law and conventions because it was diplomatic premises. Both, the host country was violated, and also Iran. So who should hold this regime accountable for such an action?
Well, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, the Iranian foreign minister was quite clear that he holds Washington responsible. Washington, the UK, and the EU, and the allies of Israel have continued supplying weapons to Israel to conduct and carry out the genocidal campaign in Palestine, but they're also supplying the weapons to carry out these kind of assassinations. And it, as you've mentioned, it's not the first, particularly on Syrian territory. And this was what made it even more heinous for me, and why everybody here is still in shock. This was around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, so 2 hours before Iftar, the breaking of fast during Ramadan. Right. It was packed full of people, the equivalent to Oxford Circus in London, and as you said, it targets what is effectively a diplomatic zone. It was the consular section, which is actually the residence, if I understand it, of the ambassador. Mm-hmm. General Zahedi was there under diplomatic immunity. So this is actually a terrorist act. I mean, I consider Israel to be a terrorist state anyway for all of its other actions, but this was a clear, under international law, a terrorist act. And yet there has been the only country calling for an emergency session at the UN Security Council is Russia. The West is saying absolutely nothing. In response, for example, the U.S. State Department spokesperson mumbled his way through his usual excuses for Israel. And this is appalling because this is plunging us into an abyss of global insecurity. The last time that this kind of act took place was a bombing by the U.S. of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, which killed three Chinese diplomats, for which the U.S. apologized and said it was a mistake. Whether we believe that or not is by the by. Mm-hmm. But this is unbelievable. Israel is pushing the boundaries of all conventions, human rights conventions, Geneva conventions, Vienna conventions, and yet the response, imagine if, for example, Russia had bombed a U.S. embassy on another country's territory, what would the response be? We would be at war now.
Exactly. Now, Richard, Vanessa mentioned the role of the U.S. So to what extent could Washington be blamed for such acts that would further actually embolden the Tel Aviv regime to perpetrate more such crimes? Also, let's bear in mind that it was U.S.-made fighter jets, it was F-35 jets performing the strikes against the Iranian embassy.
The U.S. are absolutely responsible. It's as if an American pilot dropped it himself. The U.S. Air Force dropped it themselves. There is absolutely no distinction here. And we really need to be clear on this. The United States and Israel are one, and they attacked Iran together. The munitions, the payloads, the ordnances, every nut and bolt in that fighter jet and the six missiles that were fired were manufactured by American companies. The U.S. government manufactured this and then gave an export license and permission to give this to the Zionists. And then said nothing and continues to say nothing after, you know, we have diplomats killed. I mean, even if nobody was killed, the symbolic act of attacking an embassy is outrageous. It is beyond, it is unconscionable. It is truly beyond words. I still can't digest it, you know, even after 24 hours. It is so outrageous. And right. As Vanessa pointed out, the Israelis, I mean, is there a law that they haven't broken in any jurisdiction, under any convention? I don't know at this point. But the Americans have to be held responsible. And you know, a proper government, a real government, a one that cares about international law, a civilized government, would have immediately, cut ties with the Israelis a long time ago, by the way. But after this act, let's say, cut ties and cut exports and, held an emergency session, called for an emergency session at the UN Security Council and apologized for providing these weapons.
Right. Now, Vanessa, there were multiple countries that, and international bodies, including the United Nations, for instance, they've all condemned this Israeli act of terrorism, except the West. So what is this indicative of?
Well, I mean, as I said earlier, you know, the masks are off. The fact that these U.S.-backed Zionist attacks on Syrian territory against Iranian military, against Hezbollah, against the Islamic resistance, against Syrian Arab army forces and national defense forces, because as I said, we shouldn't forget Israel carried out the attack in the northeast. Israel violated Syrian airspace and targeted east and west of Aleppo, enabling a terrorist attack on the western Aleppo axis. It carried out an attack on the Research and Development Center in Jamraya on the morning of this assassination. There, the fires were burning for more than 6 hours. And then finally, this assassination. So in 1 week, you know, Israel has violated, it's effectively declared war multiple times, and it's only because of the restraint of the resistance axis that we are not right now in a full-blown global war. And the thing is that Israel keeps pushing, it keeps provoking, and even though the response from the resistance has been very much a deterrence response, right, which is understandable, where do we go next? Are they going to bomb the presidential palace? Mm-hmm. Are they going to bomb central Tehran? I mean, this is the thing. To what extent are Israel going to push this? Yeah. To what extent do they want to expand this war?
Yeah, I don't think they dare to do that in a way. Yeah. Now, Richard, yeah. Tel Aviv, what is it doing exactly? Is it playing global bully, an outlaw or rogue regime? What is it that Israel is exactly doing, given all the crimes it's been committing in Gaza, this recent terrorist attack at Iran embassy? Is there anything on the planet that is not viable for this regime? And then they depict Iran as a menace to regional security.
No, there is nothing that the Zionists will not do. What's funny to me is that today you can be arrested on the streets of London for saying you support Hamas or you support the Palestinian resistance. Mm. And the police who arrest you for this would have been killed by the Israelis a few decades ago because this is the nature of the Israelis, and they have done this. So, you know, whether we look at the attacks on Iran, the attacks on Britain, there's a history since the very beginning, going back a century, of the Israelis behaving in this. They have effectively invented modern terrorism, and I really mean that in the literal full sense of the term. The Israelis invented modern terrorism. They started mailing parcel bombs, letter bombs, planting bombs around London. Why wouldn't they bomb their neighbors? This is how they stole the land, is it not?
Right.
And so because Iran is the only ones helping everyone to stand up for themselves and defend themselves, they try and go after Iran. It's okay. That simple. There's no other explanation.
So, Richard, we have just 1 minute. So, Vanessa, what do you see on the horizon for the West Asia region, given all this warmongering by the U.S. and Israel?
I think escalation is almost unavoidable. I mean, as I said, inside Syria now we have an increase in the terrorist attack across all axes. Really, everybody is waiting to see what Iran's response will be, and then, of course, how the Zionists will respond to that. So I think we're in abeyance, but I think we're preparing for further escalation.
Okay, that's all the time we have for this episode. Thank you so much, Vanessa Bailey in Damascus, Richard Methurst in Vienna.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 23, 2015 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with government officials on the occasion of the month of Ramadan. We have considerable experiences in the area of management. These experiences have helped us to engage in non-oil exports. The Honorable President presented the figures related to the year 1393, but even in the years before that, growth in the area of non-oil exports was tangible in the country. This is a model in itself. These capacities exist in the country. Of course, these are only part of our capacities. The experts who meet with us and who sometimes write reports for me have presented a long list of the existing capacities that can be beneficial to the economy of the country. All these things are true. These capacities should be utilized.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The current problem of the country is not that we have a shortage of projects and plans, that we do not have good ideas. Our problem is that we do not pursue good ideas and good projects the way we should. This is the basis of the issue. In intellectual environments, it is stressed that the problem of the Islamic Republic is not a shortage of good ideas. Good ideas are being expressed frequently. The problem is that these correct ideas should be pursued in a way that they lead to results. We should see the results in a very clear and visible way. Well, there are certain challenges which cause friction and corrosion. They are problematic and therefore they should be cured. One is our inner challenges, meaning adopting a simple and superficial outlook towards the problems at hand, being satisfied with some of the achievements that we make and failure to get to the depth of the problem. Mere engagement in intellectual discussion does not move the task forward. It is necessary to take action. Showing laziness in taking action is our major challenge. Sometimes conclusions and results operate on a long-term basis, not on a short-term basis, and this frustrates some people. This is one of the challenges. Sometimes great feats may be achieved in the course of a generation. Despite this, they should be pursued and we should move forward.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.